If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like arena football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Annis alongside Craig Battle and Gary Mello. Lots to get to this weekend, including heartbreak for Canada's men's basketball team. It looked like the Olympics and Rio 2016 was not just a realistic possibility, but almost fait accompli. But that's the thing about sports. You never know. Canada losing to Venezuela 79-78 in the semifinals at the FIBA Americas. It was all tied up with 24 seconds to go. Venezuela with the ball. They missed a shot at the buzzer. Looked like we were headed to overtime. Not so fast, because we're talking about international sports and a foul called with 0.3 seconds left on the clock. The Venezuelans hit one of two free throws, missed the second one intentionally. So now the Venezuelans are through into the Olympics 2016, headed to Rio. Canada has to wait for a last-ditch tournament. There's going to be three separate 16 tournaments, and the winner of all three have berths into the Olympics. Heartbreak. This is supposed to be the golden generation of Canadian basketball, Gary, and here we are. They look good at times, right? Like, and it's... It's like a sandwich where you've got the bread is the two losses. They lost the first game, they lost the second game, and whatever, the third place game, who cares? But there were some nice moments in the middle there. How will this tournament, how will this generation of basketball be remembered if this team doesn't qualify for the Olympics?
Yeah, in hindsight, it turns out that middle part was just a baloney. I guess it means absolutely nothing in the end. You know what? The most heartbreaking part of that defeat last night was that everything was lining up as it was supposed to for Canada. Like, it was a perfect scenario on Wednesday night with Mexico beating Argentina, Canada finishing first. This is a team, this Venezuelan team is a team that Canada beat by 20 points earlier this tournament. So this was a must-win game. I mean, everyone thought they were going through.
It certainly was a must-win game, and it was the first that they would have seen, you know, the Argentina loss to start the tournament. You know, everybody was, you know, wondering, was this the sign of the fact that maybe this team isn't as ready as we would have thought? You know, that the NBA talent doesn't really match, or doesn't do as much when there's no familiarity between the players, and this is the first time they'd been coming together. But the games in between really showed us sort of what they can be. They were playing together. They were passing the ball. They were playing fast break. They were hitting their shots. And the talent level was really well on display. And that kind of disappeared last night for most of that game. And, yeah, at this point, they've got a really tough road into that Olympics.
I don't want to be Mr. Knee-Jerk Sports Radio Guy, but I think this is a legitimate question. I posted on Twitter after the game. Like, this is a massive, massive choke, is it not, Craig?
I don't think you can see it as much of anything else. And whether it's, you know, you can complain all you want about that call. Should it have been made? Was it made after the time ran out, all that? But you can't be that close with a team with that little talent. Like, Venezuela has one NBA player that's shown up, and that's Grievous Vasquez, and he wasn't playing in this tournament. I don't think you can see it as anything else but a choke job.
And they had what was a comfortable lead with like 2-3 minutes left to go in the game.
Seven points.
I mean, despite them playing so poorly, they're up by seven. Like, that's a lead you need to hold on to.
Plus, that stupid Venezuelan coach, you wanted to really stick it to that guy, who I thought was going to have a heart attack on the court. He survives, and now he's headed to Rio. It is true that there are more NBAers on this Canadian team than any other team in this tournament. Like, by far. Yep. Like, way more. They've fielded a bunch of NBAers in every single game. They end up losing a pair of them, one to Argentina and one to Venezuela. But they're young NBA players, right? Like, they're and the NBA game, nobody's going to argue with you, is very different from the international game. The officiating, a large part of that as well. But is this, like, is it easy enough to say that, yeah, this is just the Canadian inexperience shining through. This will be a learning, a teachable moment, and going forward, everyone will be better off for it. Or is it hard to see that silver lining, Craig?
I mean, it's super hard to see that silver lining right now. You were facing a situation where you were playing a not that great team for a chance at the Olympics, and everybody was looking ahead to, oh, well, that gold medal game should be fun kind of thing, you know? And, you know, being a few hours out from that game and seeing them lose it, that's a big a downer on this tournament and this team.
I mean, should we look back next July during that qualifying tournament and Canada goes through the Olympics, then yeah, maybe, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, we could say that was a teachable moment. That was something they probably needed to go through to learn. But it's very real, like it's a real possibility that they do not get out of that qualifying tournament. I mean, you're going to have some big European teams there. It's going to be difficult to win one of those three tournaments. So this was their opportunity. Like, the Olympics are only every 4 years. So to miss out on Rio next year, which would have been a much bigger learning experience for this young team, that's a big blow to this program.
And I mean, okay, so we can talk about the NBA talent on that Canada team, and it completely obliterates everybody else at that tournament. But the U.S. basketball program went through something similar, right? Just sort of collecting all-stars, and there's just absolutely no way that any other team in any of the tournaments the U.S. was playing in that sort of early 2000s, like pre-Mike Krzyzewski period, had anybody even like that would match a single player on the U.S. team. But just getting a bunch of talented players together isn't really enough all the time, right? You're going to blow some teams right out.
They looked good, like, for long stretches of this tournament.
Yeah.
Like really good, mm-hmm. like dominating against a Mexican team that, granted, doesn't have, what do they have, one NBAer, if that.
Gustavo Ayons there, yeah.
Yeah, but a very difficult home crowd. And they just blew them out of the water.
Mm-hmm. And this tournament's a grind. Like, they played a lot of basketball. Yep. Like, you know what I mean? Like, going into this loss to Venezuela, they had seven straight wins where they're beating opponents by, like, an average of 26 points. Mm-hmm. Like, they looked good for a long stretch. It's not like they had two good games in a group phase and then lost in the knockouts. Like, they were looking good for a long stretch.
The competition level wasn't as good as a FIBA Americas tournament can be, though. Brazil wasn't there because they've got the automatic bid. U.S. wasn't there because, obviously, they don't need to be. So you add those two teams in, and I think it would have been a bit of a different tournament, and maybe they wouldn't have been looking past the semifinal game as the way they might have been.
How can you be looking past a game which is, like, it's the de facto final, the semifinal, when you're looking at two teams advancing to the Olympics from this tournament? The semifinals are the final. That's the goal.
Yep.
Who cares? Like, who's wearing their gold medal FIBA Americas around their neck? Who cares? Gold, silver, doesn't matter.
No,
it's all
right.
About getting into the Olympics.
The goal of this tournament was to get to the Olympics. You wanted to be in that final too. That was the goal the whole time going in. But, you know, I could see with a young team like that, a bunch of young players facing against a Venezuelan team who they beat by 20 points, that's a very good possibility. Or maybe it was the nerves. I don't know.
And maybe, like we said before, a teachable moment in terms of just sort of putting a group of talented players together and throwing them out. Maybe this is what sort of gets them to look at fit and sort of how the rotations are going to work. And it felt like last night, Triana was still experimenting with things. He was trying groups that hadn't played a ton together. He was playing guys extended minutes who hadn't seen some. He was playing guys who played a lot in that first Venezuela game, hardly at all. And, you know, I'm wondering sort of what was going through Triano's head and what he was seeing on the court that the rest of us weren't seeing. Like, I saw Andrew Wiggins not having a great first half, and then he only plays 10 minutes in the second half. Like, if I'm that coach at halftime, I'm trying to figure out how to get my best player in advantageous situations and make the defense bend to him.
And it wasn't just Wiggins, too. Like, Bennett, less than 6 minutes in the second half. Stauskas, less than four. Like, that's, you know, those are some of the players you need to rely on in a situation like that. I know they weren't playing very good basketball, but those are the guys I want on the floor.
Right.
All right, guys. So, I mean, we're beating around the bush. I mean, should Jay Triano be the head coach of this Canadian basketball team going forward, Craig? Is he the man for the job? I know he has a storied history with this team and with Canadian basketball, and obviously a legend when it comes to basketball in this country, both with the Raptors as an assistant coach and a head coach and with Team Canada. Is if you want to make that next step and you're Canada basketball, you want to not just be making Olympics but competing for medals in Olympics, is Jay Triano your man?
I think he is. at least for right now, I think, you know, at some point, Roy Rana or Dave Smart might come in and sort of take that mantle away just because of the experience they're getting sort of with this national team group and that sort of thing. But I think, yeah, between his experience in previous international tournaments, he knows the game really well. He knows the NBA players really well. Obviously, as the former coach of the Raptors, he understands the NBA game, and there isn't sort of, you know, there isn't a look at Jay Triano as like, who is this guy? Like, he's a major coach. He's a major face. He's
big pedigree.
Big pedigree. Huge pedigree. So I think that he works both for the players and for the program, and he's got a really, really good relationship with Steve Nash. I don't see Steve Nash turning on Jay Triano at this point.
I was going to say, that's something that you can't underestimate, is how close Jay Triano and Steve Nash are, and I can't see Steve Nash pulling the trigger after. He was an assassin on the court, but I don't think he's going to be an assassin in the Canada basketball offices quite that quickly. You know, I think Jay Triano at least gets this Olympic qualifying tournament next year. You know, they're not completely out of it. It will be a difficult road to go. But, you know, you're looking at this young team. They'll be another year older. You know, a lot of them will have a little bit more NBA experience under their belts. You hope to have Tristan Thompson there next time around, which would be a big help, obviously. So yeah. I think Jay Triano at least gets his qualifying tournament next summer before, you know, his fate's determined as the head of the program.
Yeah. Next year's roster could be even better, too. I mean, when you get Tristan Thompson back and you get Tyler Ennis back from injury, Jamal Murray. He's going to be a sort of in his draft year, so that might not be a perfect time for him. But it's Olympic qualifying. I mean, like, you're going to pull out all the stops.
And maybe if Jamal Murray's there, because Corey Joseph was not great in that semifinal game, maybe, I mean, not that you're going to throw an 18-year-old kid into the starting job right away, but boy, I don't know. Maybe you do.
He's a pretty special kid, right?
He looked fantastic.
And he'll be fresh off being drafted into the NBA. So was he going to be in a summer league instead of that?
I don't know. Yeah, he would forego summer league, I think.
I would hope.
Yeah, you would hope so. But I could see that team next year being, you know, very hungry. And Tristan Thompson would sort of help sort out a little bit of that rotation issue. You'd want Olynyk and Thompson playing a bunch of minutes, and then you just sort of shuffle in a couple other guys. You're not trying to work on, hey, let's get, like, all 12 players playing here except for Robert Zachary, kind of thing.
Speaking of Steve Nash, how tough was it to watch him last night on the sidelines? Like, he was on his feet the whole time. That's got to be difficult for a guy who's used to being so competitive and out on the floor being the general, to have to sit back and kind of watch that unfold.
Well, it was painful for everybody to watch, right? Like, there was the different levels of it. Part of it is that these guys aren't getting paid. They're you know, taking time out of what's supposed to be their off season to play in this tournament. Mm-hmm. Fly the Canadian colors, and to get, I don't know. There's part of it that is, sure, maybe they were jobbed a little bit, right? Like, that's, if that happens during the course of play, that call, you're saying that's a bad call.
I thought it was a foul.
Like, I think you're out on an island there, Gary.
I think, you know what? I actually think it was a foul on the play. Whether or not that foul changes anything on the play is a different story. Like, can that Venezuelan player actually get the ball and put a put back? Probably not. There was 0.3, you know, there was, I think it was 3 seconds or 0.3 seconds.
Yeah.
So I don't think he actually makes the play if he's not fouled, but I still think it was a foul.
Well, I think the trick, too, is that, you know, there's a freeze frame that went around on Twitter of, like, a zero on the game clock,
right,
and Dornikamp's hand out, you know, sort of like in the foul that was called. Is like, was it just after play actually did you know, subside? And yeah, like, it's just a strange call to make. You know, you don't see a lot of sort of offensive rebounding fouls get called. Like, it's just sort of strange to basically end a tournament on that.
No doubt. I mean, he does have to let that go in that situation, I think. You know what I mean? But the one saving grace is the game was tied. They're going to overtime, so it's not like a team's getting jobbed over it. Like, both teams are still in it. If you don't make that call, you know, you get an overtime, and then you hope the best team comes out.
Well, what is the storyline coming out of this game, though? Is it, hey, Canada choked, or they were screwed, they were jobbed out of potential win because of this last-second call? Because really, I mean, we mentioned they beat them by 20 last time they played Venezuela. They were in control in that second half and let it slip away. What is the storyline coming out of this thing, Gary?
I think they choked.
Yeah,
I do. That was a must-win game. It was the first must-win game they were playing all tournament, but a game they should have won. It's not like if they lose that semifinal game to Argentina, I can understand. But against a team that you beat handily the first time, that's a game you need to win.
Yeah, I think it leaves a bad taste in their mouths that, you know, they lost. Like, the final play was such a controversial call. But yeah, they shouldn't have been in that situation.
It is a Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Gary Mello. Now, if this was hockey, well, first of all, be unlikely that Canada would be in this situation qualifying for an Olympics in hockey. But if there was some sort of major international failure in hockey, right, there would be the calls for some sort of investigation into the national team and how things are done as far as developing young hockey players. I don't think we're going to see anything like that. And still, there is a chance to save face here with the last-ditch tournament in the summer of 2016, just before the Rio Olympics. But this is supposed to be the golden generation of Canadian basketball. Yeah, the Rookie of the Year, you got a bunch of NBA players on this team. Does it set back? Like, honestly, is this crazy to say that it sets back the development of the national team, the national program, quite a bit?
No, I think it definitely does. Like I said, you know, the Olympics is the learning experience. That's the competitive stage you want to be on. Not only is it a great learning experience for the young team, but you're playing against top competition. You want to play against the USs and the Spains and the Greece. You know, those are the matches, I think, that kind of help you grow this program and let these players get the experience they need to move forward.
Yeah, people are talking about this sweet spot for this team being sort of that 2024. So 2016 might have been just a bit of a trial by fire. Get in there and get,
sure,
you know,
you
waxed.
Get there.
You do have to get there. And maintaining interest from guys who actually didn't get to go to the Olympics, I guess you could say that they'd be extra hungry in 2020. You know, like, we got bounced in 2016. We didn't get to go. If that's what happens, they still might make that, like we said, that qualifying tournament count. But yeah, you could say that, okay, 2020, you know, they're all out. They get every single Canadian basketball player who's ever, you know, put a ball in a hoop out, and yeah, they run the table. Sure, that'd be great. But you do need to, like, you know, we were saying just now that they hadn't been punched in the mouth. They hadn't had a really tough must-win game, and now they've had one of those. It'd be great if they could have a bunch of those at the Olympics and sort of build up to that 2020-2024 run.
The only silver lining I see from that defeat last night is we get to watch the Venezuelan coach in Rio next year. That's going to be fun.
That guy is going to be fun. He needs to maybe down his intake of coffee just a little bit. Yeah, I hate to go back to the refs because, yes, again, they should not have been in that situation against a team that was heavily, Canada was the heavy favorite. I think we were 13, 14 point favorites headed into that game. But it does seem like, and I don't know if there's anything to this. I mean, and Gary, I know you watch a lot of international soccer, so.
I was going to say it was very CONCACAF field,
right,
for sure.
Right. Like, is there something to that in that international sport, whether it's basketball, whether it's soccer, whether it's whatever, it's different officiating. First of all, it's different rules in basketball, and there will be some out there who say there was some sort of conspiracy, and you could sense it in the crowd. That was clearly a pro-Venezuela crowd in Mexico City. Is there something to be said for that?
Well, you know, it always seems to be those international competitions where Canada kind of gets those screw jobs from the officials. You mentioned the CONCACAF. Like, it's been, you know, it seems like every tournament Canada's in, there's some sort of terrible call that costs them a game or a tournament. And it kind of had that feel to it last night. Maybe it's just the fact that Canadians are just, you know, just two good old Canadian boys playing the humble way, and they got to get a little bit dirtier on the international stage. Maybe they got to play a little rougher or something. I don't know what it is, but it seems to be like a recurring trend for sure.
Well, in that first Venezuela game, if I recall correctly, Craig, it was pretty physical first half at least, and the Venezuelans were really trying to get in the face of the Canadians and knock them down, put them to the floor, and it was well officiated, I thought, in that they were being called for that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it is a wake-up call to Canada as to the difference in the international game compared to the NBA game.
Just in terms of the refs and the refing and understanding
everything, all of it.
Yeah, it's all
they're
out.
Playing in an arena with a steel cage at the top of the thing.
Yeah, I think the unpredictability of it, you know, and just sort of like dealing with different refs, and like, these guys are NBA guys and they're used to a certain amount of refing and a certain amount of leeway and stuff like that. So that's another thing that you have to get to, not just the different rules, but the different ways things are interpreted and the different ways things can swing from game to game. And you know, being an international tournament, you kind of assume, unless you're playing Mexico, that you're not going to have a partisan ref, but you've got a partisan crowd, and that always affects the ref. So going in and understanding that, I mean, it's great that the Canadian women got to play their FIBA Americas tournament in Edmonton, and they walked right through it. And like, they had a talent disparity, and they totally dominated. But it is still a different game, and these guys, I think they have to have these experiences, and they have to understand that, yeah, they're not going to go for you, and they're not, you know, interested in your NBA pedigree.
Before we move on, one more thing on this Canadian basketball team is that, yes, there is still hope to make the 2016 Summer Games in Rio. It comes at the Olympic qualifying tournament next summer. It's going to be a situation where there's three separate six-team tournaments. The winner of each is into the Olympics, but you got five teams that'll come out of Europe, just the top two teams at Eurobasket make it to the Olympics, and then the next five are thrown into this thing. You will have Mexico, who lost to Argentina in their semifinal. They'll be in it as well. That being said, now save for maybe Spain and, I don't know, France, I got to think Canada is going to be the favorite in their tournament to come out of that thing. And there could be some extra players thrown into the mix here, right? Like Tristan Thompson could be there, and maybe Jamal Murray is there. Those are still question marks. I wonder if the fact that they flamed out so spectacular so spectacularly in the FIBA Americas, whether that changes the thinking of guys like a Tristan Thompson or a Jamal Murray. I would think not, and maybe even going the other way, it might make them more apt to play in this tournament next summer.
I think you're going to get earlier buy-in. I mean, you know, they're going to be involved earlier in the summer. You know, hey, we're looking at silver linings. Maybe that's a tune-up that a young, inexperienced, zero chemistry team needs, right? They haven't had a lot of experience to play together until this point with all their best players, and they haven't had Tristan Thompson and Tyler Ennis come out either, right? So, they'll get buy-in. That Olympic qualifying tournament, that six-teamer, will be massive. Everybody will know, that is the safety net for this tournament. So coming into this one, they knew that if they didn't make it, that they had that other one, in the backs of our heads, that's available. But now that is the last-ditch effort to compete at 2016 Rio, right?
You know what's the one little interesting wrinkle in this qualifying tournament next year is it's going to be held July 5th to 11th. That's right in the midst of NBA's free agent wooing period. Depending what happens with Tristan Thompson this year, whether or not he gets a qualifying offer or if he's on the free agent market next year, does something like that hold a player like him back from a tournament that's so important? That'll be pretty interesting.
Yeah, if he's unsigned, is he really going to want to go in there, throw some elbows with Team Mexico at an Olympic qualifying tournament? It's a good question. Sportsnet Magazine Live, Ben Ennis, Craig Battle, and Gary Mello. Speaking of chokes, it's hard to say it's a choke when you've won three straight Grand Slams, but Serena Williams kind of did choke to Roberta Vinci at the U.S. Open, trying to complete the Grand Slam. First time in a long time, didn't happen. Incredible story. And as dominant as she looked in that sport and has looked her entire career, it almost validates the side of women's tennis, right? Like that side of the draw where you thought, it was okay, if she wins the Grand Slam, that's an incredible accomplishment, and she already will go down as one of the greatest women's tennis players of all time. But she wasn't, I mean, there was no real competition for her. The fact that she lost in a semifinal, I don't know, it almost makes the three previous Grand Slams all that more impressive.
It certainly does. And I mean, it's, you talk about the competition on the women's side. It's not like she lost, to one of the top seeds. You're losing to an unseeded player. Like, I don't think it was the moment that got to her, was it? I mean, here's someone who's won so many tournaments, a veteran of the game. But, 17 unforced errors in that third set.
She's 60-1 underdog.
Like,
Roberta
that's unbelievable. Gee, I wish I had put some money on that. Yeah. Seriously.
It's incredible. And over on the men's side, Roger Federer refuses to age. I thought he should have retired a couple of years ago.
No.
Apparently, I was wrong. Like, this isn't supposed to happen. You're not supposed to go into your 30s and be as dominant as he's been. Now, he's not winning slams, but he's getting to finals. And, boy, he'll be a huge underdog against Novak Djokovic. But it's incredible to see what he's done, where guys like Rafa Nadal just physically can't hold up. He's well beyond him in years. Mm-hmm. And still able to compete and dominate in beating his countryman Stan Wawrinka in three sets to advance to the final.
That was incredible. Like, Stan Wawrinka has, made a major surge in recent years, has actually beaten Fed in a couple of these big tournaments, and he just walked right over him. Novak Djokovic did it in, 3-2. Three games or four games in the entire match, which is absolutely bonkers. So, and that's interesting, the comparison between Serena and Roger Federer. Serena, her biggest rival is Maria Sharapova, and that's not a contest.
No.
Serena wins every one of those walking away. But Federer's managed to extend his career into just the craziest twilight. But he's got these genuine rivals. Like Novak Djokovic is one of the best men's tennis players of all time. So is Rafael Nadal, right? So when he winds up in these situations, he's not playing some unseeded player in the final trying to get through and sort of not overlook the opponent. He's playing the number one guy who's been number one for four or five straight years. And that's just totally amazing. I think it's going to be a fantastic final.
It also comes to a point where he's a sentimental favorite going in. Like, who's not cheering for Roger Federer this weekend?
Yeah, they were saying something like the commentators last night were saying it seems like it's about 99% Federer. And that's kind of incredible because Novak Djokovic is a likable guy in his own way.
Sure. Great personality, great player.
It's not like you're dealing with sort of a wrestling heel and it's obvious that you're just going to cheer for the opposite guy.
He's no Nick Kyrgios.
There you go.
When we come back, the Maple Leafs making a new addition to Legends Row. It is Matt Sundin. He's only the franchise's all-time leading scorer, but it has some people upset. Plus, the NFL season is officially underway and are the Patriots really ballsy enough to cheat already? Week one of the NFL season, we discuss coming up next. Ben Ennis, Craig Battle, Gary Mello, Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Evan Rosser.
You've heard Raptors GM Masai Ujiri. You've heard him in press conference sound bites. You've heard him introduce players and explain personnel moves. You've even heard him talk trash and swear. But chances are you've never heard him sing. That's him, though, leading a call and response with the 50 best youth basketball players in Nigeria. It's August 2015, and Ujiri is back in the country where he grew up to run a basketball camp. Something he's done through his organization, Giants of Africa, every summer for more than a decade. This year, Ujiri and the NBA coaches and scouts he's brought over with him visited four countries in just 2 weeks: Nigeria, Ghana, Kenya, and Rwanda. It's the biggest trip Giants of Africa has ever organized, and the goal at the heart of the project is even bigger: to use basketball to lift individuals and communities and bring the entire continent of Africa together.
Until we affect these kids the right way, you know, like until we affect these kids where there are more that come after you, you know, like and are doing well, you know, like then one day, you know, like years from now, you know, like you can say, you know what, you know, maybe I had an impact in some small way or some kind of way, you know, like, but there's plenty to be done, man, you know, like this small ass head dreams like bigger than anything, you know, like. And it's filled every day, you know, like I don't sleep, I just keep thinking and thinking.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis alongside Gary Mello and Craig Battle. The Maple Leafs making their next addition to Legends Row, and it's a guy who is unquestionably a legend in the history of this franchise. All-time leader in points, Matt Sundin, the newest addition. Now, there's going to be a bunch of hand-wringing, no matter who the selection is. It's fun to do, I guess, if you're into that. But there are some names that have not been selected yet to Legends Row that maybe should have been ahead of Matt Sundin. And people will point to, Gary, the fact that those teams never made a Stanley Cup final. There wasn't a whole lot of winning going on around Matt Sundin while he was captain. Is that a legitimate argument?
I don't think so. I mean, if we're bringing that into the discussion, then you can bring any Leaf on Legends Row from the last 50 years.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since they've won a Stanley Cup or even been to a final. You know, I think this really speaks to the, you know, the fact of how underappreciated Matt Sundin was during his time in Toronto. Like, we saw it during his playing days, and, like, it seems like it continues now. Like, no, they never made the Stanley Cup final, but you could argue that he's the greatest Leaf in the history of this franchise. Like, you look at how consistent he was and how good he was. And obviously the tenure he had here, you know, people always talk about Doug Gilmore and such, but I mean, yeah, he was great, but it was a very short stint. You know, Matt Sundin was great here for a long time. You know, he's not even in the top five in games played for the franchise, but yet is the franchise leader in goals and points. So I don't even see how it's a debate on whether or not he belongs on that row or when he should go on that row.
It's almost like people have a bias against that era of Maple Leafs teams because there's such a short history of success in recent times for the Toronto Maple Leafs. The fact that they made a couple of conference finals is viewed as some real success. And while it has been like that, that's a mathematical fact for this team, having not won a Stanley Cup since 1967. It's not. I mean, you look at the other franchises that have had success over the last 50 years. Clearly, it's no matter of giant success that this team made a couple of conference finals. But I don't know. At some point, Craig, don't you think this Legends Row thing, it's for the fans? You got to have somebody in there that they actually saw play.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, there's younger people who, you know, still have Sundin jerseys. And, you know, like when he comes out onto the ice, you sort of get a sense like, oh, yeah, like we watched this guy. We cheered this guy as opposed to, you know, my dad or my grandfather cheered this guy. And it's a bit of a different thing. And it offers sort of a different, it seems to me, flavor to this burgeoning monument that the Leafs are creating. And in that sense, there's supposed to be 10 or 11 guys in this. They've announced 7. So if you're a big Dave Keon fan, like...
Right, that's the name that people say, well, he's not there and he has Stanley Cups and whatever.
Yeah, he was the MVP, the Conn Smythe winner in 1967, obviously.
Calder Trophy as well.
They're not going to forget about Dave Keon. Like, Dave Keon is going to wind up on Legends Row, which is this brand new thing.
Will he show up for it?
What? He might not.
Yeah.
Who knows? But yeah, like I imagine that Charlie Conacher might make it out there too. Like Tim Horton might make it out there. And if they don't wind up with enough space, they might build another Legends Row, right?
Ooh, like, double decker.
There you go. Yeah. Let's go with this thing. Let's build some bleachers and put these guys on it, you know? Like they're not going to forget to lionize the best Maple Leafs because that's what the Maple Leafs do, right? Like we're not going to forget about these great players. So I think the order in which they get on this thing kind of seems immaterial to me.
And I think you touch on a really good point, Ben, talking about giving something for the fans that are actually able to go down and enjoy this experience at FanFest this weekend. I mean, you know, I'm 30 years old and you know what I mean? Like even Daryl Sittler, who's not considered like one of the we're not talking about Max Bentley and Syl Apps here. Like Daryl Sittler played in the 70s and 80s, but even I remember very little about Daryl Sittler.
Right.
So I feel like giving fans a chance to go down and celebrate one of the greatest Leafs of all time, let alone the last 30 years, I think it's a great thing.
I think overall, Legends Row has been a rousing success, right? Like, I think it's a great... It's kind of sad that the Blue Jays don't have something similar. There's no statue. There's no nothing to commemorate the Blue Jays World Series titles in 92-93.
We've got Ted down there outside the building, and there have
he was a big part of 92-93.
Well, there have been some whispers, too, that Robbie Alomar, he may get a statue next year as part of the 40th.
But then they'd put Kelly Gruber ahead of Joe Carter, and we'd have to have this argument all over again.
But it's great for sports radio hosts.
You know what's a nice touch about Matt's going in today, too, that I think a lot of people haven't really touched on, is the fact that he's going in with Börje Salming. Like, those two statues are being unveiled. I think that's a nice touch. You know, you're talking about the first two Swedes into the Hockey Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. His mentor. I think that's a nice touch, having the two of them go in together.
It leads to the discussion about the actual team the Maple Leafs will ice this year as the rookie tournament underway right now. And so often in the last 22 years, we've been talking about Blue Jays are fading, and now the attention turns to the Maple Leafs, and you see very sparse crowds late in September down at Rogers Center because everybody's flipped the switch into hockey mode. Clearly that's not the case this year. Mm-hmm. All the pressure entirely off the Maple Leafs. They're not expected to do squat. They're expected to be once again near the top of the lottery, if not the worst team in the Eastern Conference. But maybe there's something there. I mean, there's we expect some good young players. They added a couple of veterans that are hoping to be dealt at the deadline. Is it possible that this is the perfect mix to actually surprise and maybe compete for a playoff spot?
I think it'll be a tough thing for the Maple Leafs to do. I mean, the one wild card on all this is Mike Babcock. Like, they bring in a great coach in Mike Babcock, who's known to, you know, get great, you know, effort and performance out of his players. And that's the one thing that can kind of push that team to be in that discussion. But if you look at the talent, I just don't think it's there on this squad.
Right. I think you can hope for, and, you know, what the Brain Trust was saying this week about what you're going to see is a team that really works hard. And we're not aiming to make the playoffs this year. We're aiming to put a good product on the ice that you can get behind and that's going to put all-out effort for you, which is something that you really couldn't say about last year's Maple Leafs, especially after the writing seemed to be, you know, on the wall, like, okay, yeah, this team is fading. And then it just got worse and worse as the season went on. So I think sort of rebuilding a sense of trust between the team and the fan base is goal number one, which seems to me like a really sound way to go about things. I think they could surprise, and that would be great, but, you know, I think it'd be just icing on the cake of a season in which they're just sort of honest about where they're at and where they're going
to
be.
I think this is the first season in a long time where a lot of Leaf fans, or at least the ones that I've spoken to, are more excited about the rookie tournament this weekend than the actual season, because you get to kind of see a little bit of the Marners and the Nylanders and the Kapanens, and those are guys that are not necessarily guaranteed to make this Leaf lineup this year, you know, especially like Marner and probably Kapanen to a lesser extent. So, you know, you kind of get to see a bit of the future of the team, and I think there's a little bit more excitement about that than the actual season that's coming up.
Yeah. It seems like an ideal scenario to be either a player on this team, Mike Babcock, Brendan Shanahan, the expectations are low. You can do whatever you want this year almost. I mean, what qualifies as a failure for this team this year?
Finishing ninth.
Maybe.
That would be a failure.
I don't know. Would it, though? Because if they finish ninth and Nylander scores 25 goals and maybe Mitch Marner actually, you know, presses to make this team and Jonathan Bernier turns into a number one, like, isn't that kind of a success still?
Well, sure. If you throw those chips on the table, of course, that's
different. That's happening if they finish ninth, isn't it?
Well, possibly. I mean, I can't see.
How do they finish ninth without that happening?
Hard effort. It's all about the effort. Grinding out 2-1 games.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis, Craig Battle, Gary Mello. The NFL season officially underway with Thursday's 28-21 win for the Patriots over the Steelers. And yes, Al Michaels talking about gambling late in this game with that cover touchdown by the Steelers. Meaningless, but it was, yes, a 7-point spread, maybe 6.5, 7.5, depending on where you shop for it. But first game for Tom Brady, he goes berserk. And of course, we couldn't be talking about the Patriots without some sort of potential scandal, maybe some radio malfunctions, maybe some hijinks being played here by the Patriots. They're not like, are they that ballsy, Craig, that they can be messing with the Steelers headsets in week one after all that's gone on this offseason?
Well, yeah, ESPN comes out with a story this week about, you know, all the things we never heard about Spygate. And one of those revelations was that it's common for teams to mess with headsets, and it sort of happens every once in a while. It's not a very big deal, but that it happens all the time at Gillette Stadium. So either they've got the worst AV team in the history of corporations, or, yeah, they're just that gutsy, and they want to say, like, what message can we send to people that we're not going to stop looking for every advantage? Okay, let's just mess with let's give them our radio broadcast.
Sorry, guys, I couldn't hear you. My headset was cutting out there.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure
what you said. Sorry about that.
Yeah,
sorry.
No, but you're right. Like, to do it right out of week one, and, you know, the way the Steelers' defense was playing, it's almost cruel that they even had to, like, they didn't even have to mess with the headsets.
Right.
Like, they didn't know to cover Gronkowski. Like,
yeah, and I mean, like, benefit of the doubt, it could just be, they said it was due to the rain.
I'm
not sure. I know I don't set up a lot of headset systems and, you know, like, wireless communication, but hey.
Apparently they're still using rabbit ears to hook all that stuff up. Like,
I can't believe that anybody is that gutsy.
Tom Brady with the 4 touchdown passes, 25 of 32, no interceptions. We all figured he'd be a man on a mission this year, but that is, I mean, to come out and throw up that kind of display in lousy weather, mind you, and a team coming off a Super Bowl win, no hangover by any stretch of the imagination. This team kind of looks like a juggernaut once again, Gary.
Oh, no doubt. It's a team that you can't be reckoned with. I mean, whenever you have Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, like, you'd be foolish to not consider them in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And then you look at that, you know, that AFC East, like, who's going to challenge him? Will it be the Jets? I don't know. I don't think so.
The Dolphins will be right there. It leads to the discussion. We got a couple of minutes before we got to take the break. The Bills, so much are expected of them. They already are at the level where they have, like, frankly, a championship-level defense. Now, if they could put any type of offense on the field, it would make for a very, very interesting season. Tyrod Taylor will get the start week one at quarterback, and I say just week one because who knows? It's definitely a fluid situation, and certainly, Craig, it looks a little different in that division if Tom Brady's missing 4 games because he plays the Bills next week, but it's going to be tough, and I don't know. It's hard to envision them really challenging the Patriots atop that division.
It is. I mean, not only were they supposed to get the Patriots without Brady, you know, facing Jimmy Garoppolo is a much different scenario, even with, you know, the weapons, the Rob Gronkowski and the two TE sets and stuff like that. But still, it's a tough division. I mean, the Jets aren't nearly as bad as they've looked in the past. They've got a great defense. Miami's a much improved team. So now you've got a murderer's row of teams to play within your division. On top of, yeah, you know, having a fully healthy, fully motivated Patriots team. So, yeah, I think that the Bills have a really uphill struggle, but Tyrod Taylor, for all intents and purposes, could be an upgrade from what they've gotten. Rex Ryan, I don't think you're going to see a different starter in week two or three. I feel like Rex Ryan is pretty loyal to his quarterbacks. He kept Mark Sanchez in there.
He got a tattoo of him, my goodness. I can't wait for the Tyrod Taylor tattoo, right? That'd be great.
Question's where he's going to put it. On his wife's foot, maybe. Who knows?
Oh, no.
Tyrod Taylor, he essentially... I mean, you're relying on a guy that has no career starts. He's made a total of like 35 passes in four seasons with the Ravens. Like, this is something that it's hoping that he pans out. It'll be fun to watch. I mean, he had a great career at Virginia Tech, so it'll be interesting to see if he can actually do this for the Bills. That's the one wild card for them this season.
And I think you had the three options there. Matt Castle, you know, he's just really uninspiring. He's a game manager at best. You've got EJ Manuel, who just can't hit guys on crossing patterns. Like, when your quarterback has real accuracy issues and can't anticipate, you've got nothing heading in. So he's a scrambler too. But so Tyrod Taylor, he runs a crazy fast 40. They'll get him to do some stuff that, you know, he's comfortable with. Hopefully, you know, use the running game a ton and see where he goes. But yeah, I think, you know, in hindsight, looking back at his decision, it kind of makes sense.
When we come back, Blue Jays with a double header today, weather permitting. As they wrap up this four-game series, the biggest in 22 years for the Blue Jays against the Yankees, the lead now 2.5 games atop the American League East. Alongside Craig Battle and Gary Mello, I'm Ben Ennis. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake doctor's orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Donaldson blasts one deep left center field. There's his major league leading 13th first inning home run. And the Blue Jays are in flight here in New York, leading 2-0 as Josh hits his 38th.
Holly came from Miami.
1102 Sportsnet Radio Network. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis, Craig Battle, Gary Mello. Blue Jays hammer the Yankees 11-5 in game one of their four-game set yesterday. Josh Donaldson continuing his moonwalk to the American League MVP award. Like, that's not, and it's not even close anymore, right? Like, no. Is anybody talking about Mike Trout? I don't even remember. His name is Mike Trout, right? Yeah, so was I.
Yeah, I was all about Trout. Like, I didn't think Donaldson had a chance to even catch Trout in this race. I think he's the best player in baseball, and I thought, well, in the last month, man, things have really changed.
Yeah, I feel like last time I was in the show in August, we were just doing a Mike Trout love and just sort of like looking at the stat sheet and just sort of sitting here with our mouths open. It was great. But no, like, he's completely fallen off just as Donaldson just keeps trucking along.
And his fall off has coincided with the Angels kind of dropping back a bit as well, and outside of the wild card picture, still in it, but just outside. And, you know, they were in the first spot, wild card spot initially, but you're right. It's, you know, they've coincided. It shows how important Mike Trout is to that team.
Yeah, and it shows you how important Josh Donaldson is to this Blue Jays team. So they take game one of the four-game series, doubleheader today. We'll get into that a little later on this hour as we wrap up Sportsnet Magazine Live. But game one, you got your ace David Price on the hill, making his eighth start as a Blue Jay, and he only goes five, but gives up two earned runs and seven strikeouts. He was fine, and you take him out of that game because it's 9-2, and it gets a little close at one point, and at 9-5, maybe it's not as comfortable as you would have liked it, but then Blue Jays tack on a couple more there. But about as good a start as you can have to a baseball game when you hit a couple of two-run shots in that first inning. You take a 5-0 lead, and David Price hasn't even thrown a pitch. There's been moments, guys, where we've, I mean, the last series at Yankee Stadium, the three-game set, the Blue Jays eventually went on to sweep. You went into that one saying, all right, this is time now to see the rubber meeting the road. They were not in first place at the time, thought it was almost impossible to make up the ground that they needed to because they were 8 games back of the division not that long before they went into that series. They won all three games. This is, once again, a big series. Is it still a situation, though, where this team needs to prove itself? Or has it proven itself already to you, Gary?
I think they've proven that they are a playoff team in the American League. It's a question of whether or not they're winning the division or going through as a wild card. And the position they're in right now, being up 2.5 games with, you know, this 3 games remaining in New York and having another home series with the Yankees, I think this weekend is a chance for them to kind of really put some distance between themselves and the Yankees. I mean, the Yankees have had some injury issues. Everything is going right for the Blue Jays right now. So if they can get 3 or 4 this weekend, I think that's a big power play for locking up the AL East.
Say what you will about the Yankees, and you're right, they are banged up, and the news that Mark Teixeira is out for the rest of the season with a broken leg is not good news. Greg Bird has done a nice job filling in, but he still has a lot to prove as far as being on the level of a Mark Teixeira. But that team does have pretty good starting pitching, and Luis Severino, the young fireballer, was a key part of what's made them so good here recently, because they've been right there in lockstep with the Blue Jays. Just, you know, the Blue Jays were winning 21 out of 25, and the Yankees just kept hanging around a game and a half, half game back at times. Severino's been very good, and then he gets lit up by the Blue Jays. Mm-hmm. Like, that, to me, sent a message that it doesn't matter. And there's been a sect of, I guess it's the Twitter world that says, well, yeah, the Blue Jays, they score a bunch of runs, but usually against the crappier starters in Major League Baseball. It doesn't matter who's out there. On any given day, they can put a hurting on somebody, including Luis Severino yesterday, Craig. I mean, that was impressive.
Oh, absolutely. And how good do you feel? And this is a strange feeling for watching the Blue Jays. Sort of you're heading into a big game. You get a 5-run first inning, and then you've got David Price coming out to pitch the bottom half of the inning. Like, how great is that? Like, they're, you know, most nights, David Price is going to give up, a couple of runs, 2-3 runs, and he's going to go deep. Like, this is a strange situation. They only went 5 innings. But having an ace on your team to pitch that game in that situation in Yankee Stadium facing a fireballer, Yankees are, you know, neck and neck for the lead in the division. And then you get 5 runs and you get to have David Price come out. Like, that is a comfortable feeling. That game never really felt like it was in question until, it got on and, you know, we're in the 6th inning and we suddenly got only a four run lead. That is a fantastic feeling and very, very rare for this franchise.
And that was a game that was very important for the Blue Jays. You're coming into this 4-game set in New York. You kind of want to set the tone, especially when you have your ace on the mound. Like, that's a game you want to win and kind of set up for the rest of the weekend, especially with a doubleheader Saturday. You never know. You could probably get a split. You know, that's how these doubleheaders tend to work out. But, you know, it's a game that they went in, and David Price was kind of grinding through his 5 innings, like 96 pitches. They kind of pulled him. It would have been nice to get, you know, if those 96 pitches got your next inning or two, especially with a doubleheader on Saturday and not having to go to your bullpen too much.
Yeah.
So it's a big victory for that team to set up this series, for sure.
And no pitcher is going to go out and, you know, throw a 9-inning complete game shutout every single time.
No.
So you got to basically spend a David Price semi-off night. For him, that's a semi-off night, right?
Yeah.
And you got to use that in a game where they got 5 runs in the first inning and wound up winning going away anyway, right? That's fantastic. And I think going into this series with the Boston series just in the rearview mirror, and it took 10 innings to get that one win out of 3 games, there was just sort of a little trepidation creeping in. You know, this is massive, and they're not coming in, you know, all guns blazing, et cetera. Getting that first win out of the way is such a nice feeling heading into the rest of the weekend. And now they're like 9-4 against the Yankees throughout the season. So one more win, and they sort of sew up any tiebreaker that they'll need sort of going forward.
The Yankees weren't coming into this series guns a-blazing either, losing 2 out of 3. Mm-hmm. To the Baltimore Orioles. Now, the leadoff spot with this Blue Jays team has been an area of some consternation, and it started with Troy Tulowitzki's insertion atop the lineup and his struggles, by and large, there. He's starting to come around recently and hitting some balls hard, but he is now the number 5 hitter on this team, and Ben Revere has been thrown atop the lineup, where he started off, I think he was 0-for-11 to start his Blue Jays career. The guy gets multiple hits every day now, it seems. Took a walk yesterday, was on base 3 times, stole a base. It really seems like it's difficult at this moment, and I don't know why you would mess with what's happening right now, but that looks pretty good atop your lineup when you have a Ben Revere who can get on base the way he has with this team. Not to say that it will continue. In fact, you look at his career history, he's never really done this to this level before, Gary, but he but he can hit. I mean, how do you like Ben Rivera atop this lineup?
I mean, I like it. I mean, the one knock against having him in that spot has been him not being able to take a walk. And, you know, we saw that, you know, that last night. If they can get more of that from Ben Rivera, I think that will go a long way in setting up this lineup. I prefer Tulo in that five spot personally. So I think if you can get that production from Rivera, especially with Devin Travis looking like that's not going to happen, like his return seems pretty unlikely at this point. So if he can give you that type of production and give that to you for the last month of the season and hopefully into the playoffs, I think that's a perfect spot for both Rivera and Tulo to be in this order.
Ben Rivera on twice. He scored a run, and Troy Tulowitzki, 2 for 5. He had an RBI and a run scored as well, now hitting .234. Now, we know Russell Martin's had a tough go of it offensively recently. Big breakout game for him yesterday. A couple of home runs, 3 for 5, 4 RBIs. He's now hitting .241 with an on-base of .328 this season. And we know the offense is not everything for Russell Martin. He was brought in here, yes, to provide offense, but by and large, be a great defender behind the plate, be a great receiver, and work with this pitching staff very well, which he's done, by and large. And there's been some constants in this lineup. Like Josh Donaldson, day one through day whatever it was, 130 whatever, yesterday, he's been great. But if they get some of the guys who have been a little inconsistent, like Russell Martin, if Troy Tulowitzki turns into Troy Tulowitzki, like there really is no place that you can pitch this team.
No, I mean, there shouldn't be. By all rights, this is at least 6 or 7 deep guys who should be more often than not messing up your starting pitching, your bullpen. And I think, we're seeing a little bit of a turnaround from Troy Tulowitzki. He batted like .214 or something in August, and it's creeping up. He's had a couple of multi-hit games in the last week. And seeing him there, and maybe sort of that's the sort of comfortability with the rest of the lineup. Who knows? I think, if you can get him hitting like he does, he's the, acknowledged, best shortstop in the league, So let's see him play like that. And that's actually says a lot about their August, that they dominated the way they did with him not playing near his potential. So there's still upside for this team, which is kind of a scary thing.
And that's the beauty with this lineup, too. Like, a player like Russell Martin can go into an 0-for-13 right, and not, it doesn't really raise any flags. And then he goes out last night and hits 2 home runs. Then that's fantastic, right?
Yeah, and it helps when Edwin Encarnacion has reached base in 40 straight games. And
his numbers right now are ridiculous. Because remember, it was not, and he's a streaky guy, we know, and the last month has been ridiculous. But there was a point there in May, June, where you thought, geez, what's going on? The numbers now .271, .364, and a slugging of .538 with seemingly a home run every day.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's been, outside of Donaldson, this team's best hitter for the last month and a half, which is incredible.
And that's a very Edwin thing to do. He always seems to go on these streaks. This year's was a little bit later than what we've seen in most seasons, but it's you knew it was coming.
Yeah, and it's just so amazing that, at the trade deadline, I have no idea if this happened internally at all, but outside, in the Twitter sphere and sort of baseball conversations, it was like, maybe they need to trade one of Edwin or Jose. And it was at the time, you don't want to trade Edwin at a low point. And now he's fantasy genius, fantasy savior, having a 1.3 OPS or something over that stretch, which is just bonkers.
I think what Craig is suggesting is they should trade him.
Can they figure out a way to trade him right now?
Yeah, because he's at a high point in his value.
Yeah, he's at a high point.
Let's wait till after the weekend series.
11:13, Sportsnet Radio Network, Sportsnet Magazine Live, Ben Ennis, Craig Battle, Gary Mello. So 40,222 at the stadium yesterday, which, according to ESPN, makes it 81% full. It looked a lot less than that, and it is a late-arriving crowd in the Bronx. I get that. And so much has been made, and maybe internally, by Torontonians about the attendance that they have gotten over the last few weeks now that this team is in contention for the first time in 22 years. It's been incredible. Ton of sellouts, selling out games against the Indians midweek. Are they, what's the deal with that? That's disappointing. You're talking about New York City. You're talking about the most storied franchise probably in North American professional sports, and the Yankees. They're a game and a half out of first place. The team in first place arrives at your stadium, and it looks fairly sparse. It's not a loud crowd by any stretch of the imagination. Like the Blue Jays, right now, I don't know, you're going to get much argument on this point, They have a better home field advantage than the New York Yankees do, Gary.
Well, it's funny. I remember about a month ago, that first week of August, the Jays had a home series against the Minnesota Twins. And at the time, they were kind of, you know, battling with the Twins for one of those wild card spots. And the attendance, I want to say, was somewhere between 25 and 30.
Yeah, it was like 30-ish.
Yeah, and there was some outcry about that. You know, like, why are there more people at the Rogers Center right now? You know, this is a game that means something in the playoff picture. So I can't understand what the people in New York are doing. If you're not going to a Blue Jays-Yankees series, a four-game set that could help, you know, decide the winner of the division, like, I don't know what's going on. Maybe the weather played a part in it?
It's possible, but is it possible that New York doesn't believe in this Yankees team? Is it possible that, you know, and I'm not thinking that the Mets are actually stealing their thunder. It's never going to happen. But is it a potential smokescreen team we're looking at?
Well, and, you know, the point has been made that this team doesn't have a star on it, right? Like, there's no Derek Jeter and there's Alex Rodriguez, but we know he's not exactly a fan favorite. And they were more than happy to jump all over his golden sombrero 0-for-4 with 4 strikeout game yesterday. There isn't that superstar. There's not that fan favorite of a Derek Jeter or a Bernie Williams or a whatever. I don't know. I don't know if it should necessarily matter if you're right there in the middle of a pennant race.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. I think you're generally year after year coming out for the pinstripes, you know, like you just sort of assume that there would be, you know, that 40,000 would be your kind of baseline for that franchise. The amount of people that are so close and that, you know, follow that team forever. It's essentially sort of Maple Leafs we're talking about. Like, you'd never see 80% at a Maple Leafs game in a playoff race. That's just ludicrous. So yeah, the number one team coming to town, a win for the Yankees means you're 0.5 games out heading into the weekend. That's a high leverage situation and a big time game. Now to see them not show up, it's smacks of something, you know, a lack of belief.
Buck Martinez and Pat Tabler got into a conversation that I've had about 500 times over the last couple of weeks on this radio station. And indulge me for a second, gents, as I ask you this question. It is September. And the rosters expanded 40 men. That game took almost 4 hours, as, you know, any Yankee game is wont to do. But it maybe doesn't take as long if you can't bring in 1,000 relievers like you can with the expanded rosters. And, yeah, Buck and Pat mentioned, hey, you play the entire season under one set of rules, and then all of a sudden the most important games of the season, you play by different rules. What do you think of the expanded 40-man rosters?
Well, I mean, it's one of those situations where, in, you know, New York's case and Toronto's case, you're kind of got one eye on the playoffs right now, and you kind of don't want to burn guys out. You know, there's all this talk about Russell Martin and how his production was dipping, and, you know, they wanted to give him more days off to kind of avoid that fatigue towards the end of the season. So, I mean, yeah, they're playing by different rules, but it seems like all those teams that are in the playoff race are kind of playing by those same rules right now, and I think it's, you know, they all have the same intentions.
Why is it such a drastic jump?
Yeah, it's a 15 extra players you get to play with come September 1st because there's no minor league season anymore. And I guess you don't want those guys just having their season ended, but I don't know. Why not? I just, to me, it's crazy that you can use the number of relievers the Yankees did yesterday and the Blue Jays used a bunch yesterday as well. And I know it's not really a concern to have a doubleheader like they do today because there are so many bullpen arms in there, and they put Devin Travis on the 60-day DL so they can call up Chad Jenkins. There's just 1,000 relievers there in that bullpen. You can't even get a seat. I don't know. It just seems to me very odd, and I don't know what the solution is. Maybe it's just to eliminate the expanded rosters altogether, but I don't know. Just to me, it seems a little bit bizarre. Chris Colabello's into the lineup today, guys. He's playing first base for the Blue Jays after Justin Smoak's big game yesterday, coming through in that first inning with the 2-run shot, ends up 2-for-4 and a walk. Overall on the season, he's played great defense. And we know you can't discuss Justin Smoak without starting with the defense he plays at first base. A very weird error that he committed yesterday. I think it was only his third of the season. But for a corner infielder, to have an on base of just 300 is quite low. Like, that's not great. And we know there's power there, and certainly at Yankee Stadium, he's a guy well worth getting the start at first base. But Chris Colabello, at every opportunity, has performed offensively. And we know he's making strides defensively. He's working with Louis Rivera at first base, getting better at stretching. I've noticed in the last couple of weeks, it seems no matter how routine the throw, he's making that stretch off of first base to try and extend towards the ball. He seems to be making strides defensively. Should he be getting more starts over Justin Smoke at first base?
I mean, I don't think it's that much of a drop-off if you're going from Justin Smoke to Colabello. I mean, at least not defensively, I don't think. But it's one of those things where you're going to a doubleheader today, so it makes sense to kind of give him that start and that play. But I don't think it's that much of a drop-off.
No, and I like Justin Smoke. I'm confident in his defense. I like the home run power. But, I don't think there's that big a drop-off between him and Colabello defensively. And Colabello just gets on base more. Yeah, like you said, the 300 OBP is nothing that you want from your first baseman. But, I am a bit of a Smoke fan. I like the threat of the power. And, he digs so much at first base that you have just absolute confidence in him being there.
And anytime you can throw another left-handed bat into the mix with that short porch in right field at Yankee Stadium,
yep.
Never a bad idea. When we come back, all right, it's Strosmas, or I don't know, Stromas?
Stromas?
Stromas. Strosmas right. Or yeah. Stromas? I don't know. Marcus Stroman is going to make his first start of the season. How about that? In game two of this doubleheader today at Yankee Stadium, of course, weather permitting, that you can watch on Sportsnet here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We'll get into projecting where he fits into this team for the rest of the season and then into the playoffs, plus the future of Mark Burley and his health and Drew Hutchison, because you got six starters right now. You only need five during the regular season and only four come playoff time. So what does that mean for this Blue Jays team going forward? This is Sportsnet Magazine Live alongside Craig Battle and Gary Mello. I'm Ben Ennis. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Arden Zwelling.
Started from the bottom, now we're here.
When Marcus Stroman tore his ACL during spring training, fans, media, and even his team said we'll see you in 2016. But he had other ideas.
Even when I couldn't walk, I was throwing. So I was sitting down, had my glove, throwing, spinning the ball, throwing changeups. I kept a feel throughout the whole entire summer.
Over the next 6 months, Stroman went on a journey unlike anything he's ever experienced in his life. It was a half-year test of his patience, resolve, and motivation to return from an injury that was supposed to rob him of his sophomore major league season.
I stayed upbeat. It was a tough, long process, but we did it. We made it, and we're here, and I cannot be more excited.
Go inside the trainer's rooms, inside the classrooms, and inside the rehab of a young pitcher who was determined to pitch for the Blue Jays in September, and find out just how Stroman did it. Started from the bottom, now the whole team here.
Started from the bottom, now we're here. That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet Magazine on newsstands now. And available on Next Issue or by downloading the Sportsnet Magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand, absolutely free.
Sportsnet Radio Network, Sportsnet Magazine Live, Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Gary Mello. The Blue Jays getting set to play a true doubleheader. That's a legit doubleheader. Imagine you paid to go see a game between the Blue Jays and Yankees September 12th, and you get two for the price of one, and you get to see Marcus Stroman. That's a good night, right?
That is.
It's a very solid game.
Thank for your buck.
You're upset if you had tickets to that Thursday game, and you're not able to. Although I guess you could exchange them unless they're sold out today for today's game. I'm not sure exactly how that works out, but either way, the Blue Jays playing a double dip against the Yankees after yesterday's 11-5 win. David Price over Luis Severino. Marco Estrada gets the start in Game One against Michael Pineda. Game Two sees Marcus Stroman against Ivan Nova. It's been a long time coming, and just two rehab starts for Stroman before he makes his season debut, but he will pitch in the major leagues, which is incredible considering where we were and how definitive it seemed that he would miss the entire season when he went down with that tear of the ACL in spring training. it just sucks that he's just such a morose guy, Craig. Like he's just so down.
Yeah, I feel like he's got a big lack of confidence. Like, you know, just, yeah, totally morose, you know, never smiling, doesn't like to talk to the media. No, I feel like if confidence is a prerequisite for this, you know, big a leap from being surefire out for the season with an ACL injury to starting in Yankee Stadium after like, what, 8 innings of rehab pitching, then it's Marcus Stroman. He can do it, right? Yeah, he didn't look fantastic in that second rehab start, but in talking with Arden's Welling, SportsCenter's Arden's Welling after the game.
He's like his personal biographer these days.
Pretty much, yeah, yeah. You know, they're besties, they're Facebook friends, I don't know. yeah, in talking with Arden, Arden relaying the quotes, he basically was like, yeah, I felt great. My stuff was going. The things that weren't working, I know exactly what I'm doing. I'm going to fix them. We're going into this next thing. I can't wait to start. Like, I want to start for the team. I can't wait to get back. But yeah, just super upbeat, super excited. He's going to have a ton of energy. You hope the energy doesn't work against him in a situation like that. But yeah, he's confident, and you know, that's all you can really ask for at this stage of the game.
I think everybody probably would have felt a little bit more comfortable if he had one more minor league start under his belt.
And I'm sure he would have if the minor league season continued, right?
Exactly. I mean, he had that good performance with Lansing, which was expected. You know, the Buffalo one in Pawtucket didn't go so well. So I think if that, you know, minor league season was 1 week longer, we'd be seeing one more Stroman start with the Bisons before seeing him pitch for the Jays. But, you know, at the same time, I feel like there is a little bit more of, you know, it's a bit more poetic that he's kind of starting in New York. Let's face it, when he went down in spring training, he was kind of lined up to be the opening day starter, which was in New York against the Yankees, you know, in his hometown, you know, in his home state. So I think it's good that he's getting this opportunity. He said it from day one that his goal was to be back and pitch in September. So he's worked hard for this. So he's gotten his opportunity. Let's see what he can do with it.
Well, on the surface, it's quite a coup. A team that now has a 2.5 game lead atop the division gets a pitcher back who was supposed to be its best start of the season. Mm-hmm. Like that's incredible that you get a guy. And if you've read any of the stuff on FanGraphs recently that they've written about Stroman comparing his different pitches to some of the great pitchers in Major League Baseball, like that's high praise for a guy who's does not have a full year under his belt in the Major Leagues of Baseball. That being said, I mean, are we almost expecting too much out of him? Because, like I said, he does not have a full year of Major League service time under his belt, Gary?
I mean, the one saving grace is he's not coming back from an arm injury, right? It's not like we're talking about he's coming back from Tommy John. I think there'd be a lot more concern if there was a problem with his elbow or his shoulder or something along those lines. It was his knee. So, I mean, he looks like he's in the best shape of his life. He says he's in the best shape of his life. So I'm feeling a little bit more confident going into this start because of that.
I'm in the best shape of my life, right?
Yeah, you are. You don't look it, but I'll take your word for it. What are we expecting? Is it Craig, where we'd be shocked if he got lit up? Like what's respectable? What should we expect? Is it 5-6 innings, 1-2 runs, 3 runs? We don't know what kind of a pitch limit he'll be on. He threw about 70 in Pawtucket against the Red Sox with the Bisons. Like what's a reasonable expectation for Marcus Stroman making his first start of the season?
And I don't think you're worried about his arm so much, so I'm not exactly concerned with the pitch count. I think he got up to 81, and so, you know, they were saying, you know, maybe he stretches it out to 95 or something like that in this next start as he sort of works it up. Yeah, I'd be happy with 5-6 innings of 2 or 3 run ball for a guy making his first start of the season. Like, you should expect a little rust, right? Like, this is a guy who is essentially making a spring training start. Like, you know, he's just working his way into, you know, mid-season form kind of thing. I think, you know, it'll work in the Jays' favor. I mean, like, obviously the Jays have Mark Burley, who's, you know, been ground down over the course of the season, and a lot of teams have starters in the same spot, right? But that the long 162-game grind really, really hurts them over the course of the season, and the Jays have potentially their best pitcher and, you know, second best now to David Price coming in fresh as a daisy in the beginning of September. So that could really work in their favor. In the first start, though, I mean, between nerves and the hometown and Yankee Stadium and the weight of the game and stuff like that, obviously he didn't see anything like this. He's seen, you know, big moments. He's seen Yankee Stadium, but they weren't really in a serious playoff push, or at least not this type of playoff push last year. So he's never seen anything like this. If he can get a decent start, I'm not expecting 7 innings. I'm not expecting 10 strikeouts. If he can get a decent start and set up the bullpen with a bit of a lead, then hey, I'm happy about that.
I'm curious to see how short his leash is.
Right.
Like, what is when? At what point does John Gibbons give him the hook? Like,
if second game of a doubleheader, too.
Exactly. So mm-hmm. if that bullpen is taxed after game one, you know what I mean, and you kind of have to hope to get a few more innings from Marcus Stroman, but. When does he come out of the game? If he's struggling at 80, 85 pitches, is Gibbons giving him the hook then?
It almost would have made more sense to start him in game one, wouldn't it?
Considering he was due to start today anyways.
Yeah. Right, yeah. It is a little confusing that he would start the second game of the double dip. But talking about expectations and where the Blue Jays rotation goes from here, what does it take to have Marcus Stroman not make his next start in 5 days, right? Like, this is, I think it's more in that direction as opposed to does he have to show something to earn a start. I think he's already been penciled into the Blue Jays starting rotation plans going forward. And what does that mean for a Mark Burley, a Drew Hutchison, Gary?
Mark Burley, I think, is an interesting one because, you know, they sent him home, gave him that cortisone shot, and he's probably going to be starting in Atlanta, it looks like. So I think Mark Burley would have to really blow up to play his way out of the rotation. I think Drew Hutchison might be the odd man out here. Marcus Stroman today, he would have to have a spectacular meltdown to not get another start at this point.
Yeah, I don't see, knock on wood or whatever, I don't see that happening. I don't see him flaming out in the first inning and that becoming a discussion for the team to have. But yeah, even if that does happen, I think the upside with Stroman and, you know, there has to be some sort of a teething process in this. Like, there has to be some kind of, like, yeah, the rehab start that didn't go quite so well. That's a bit of a hiccup, and you kind of expect those, right? So
even last year when he was so good, he had those bumps in the road, mm-hmm. right? And one was at Yankee Stadium where he got lit up pretty good by the Yankees. He had a bad start in Chicago against the White Sox. He's had those starts. It would really make things difficult, though, if he started off his season with one of those starts, right? Like, if he goes out there, doesn't get out of the second or third inning, it really does kind of throw a wrench into the plans, because you know how inconsistent Drew Hutchison's been. You know mm-hmm. how banged up Mark Burley is. I mean, that's a nightmare scenario, and certainly we don't expect it to happen, but could very easily.
I think it certainly could happen that he gets blown out of this game pretty quickly. But I think with Drew Hutchison at this point, you're kind of aware of what he's going to give you, that inconsistency is really par for the course with Hutch this season. He's got a 9.5 ERA on the road. He's got a 2.5 at home. You don't know what you're going to get, and that's got to be terrifying. So Stroman, if he gets blown up, it's not the start of a trend. That's just him getting blown up in one game. You can hope that next game he's going to get a little bit better, and he's going to get a little bit better. Like, nobody expects everybody coming out in spring training to be throwing perfect on the corners. You know, like, you expect a little bit of process. So I feel like if that happens today, we can say, okay, great. You know, maybe next start he's going to be a little bit tighter. He's going to, fix some stuff. He's, he's seeing big league pitching for the first time, or big league hitters for the first time this season. You can, expect him to make some adjustments and move forward.
How likely is it that we've seen the last start of the season for Drew Hutchison, Gary?
I think it's very likely. I think the one thing that might save Drew Hutchison's season is if Burley continues to have issues. Because, going into the playoffs, you'll probably go to a four-man rotation. So you've got, Price, Dickey, Estrada probably, and you hope that Stroman or Burley is that fourth guy. And if you can have five of them going on all cylinders, then that's great. But I think Drew Hutchison, I think he might get one more start, but beyond that, I'd be shocked if he gets much more than that.
And based on that home road split, you'd hope that next start is at home against the Red Sox, where you can try to sort of put the memory of this week's start out of his head and play them at home in the confines of the Rogers Center, where he seems more comfortable. But yeah, putting him in a game in Atlanta, even though Atlanta isn't a great team by any stretch of the imagination, who knows how legit that disparity home road split is going forward. But he doesn't seem comfortable on the road. Every game at this point is a need to win game. You want to win as many of these games as possible, just to put as much of a cushion between you and the Yankees as possible. Just because you don't want to be in that wild card game. You'd much rather start a playoff series at home.
I imagine Hutchison, if he gets one more start, it's probably against the Red Sox next week.
Yeah, maybe. And the Red Sox look like a much improved team from where mm-hmm. they were early in the season. Could be a force to be reckoned with as early as next season. 11:43, Sportsnet Radio Network. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis alongside Gary Mello and Craig Battle. There was a story. John Lott wrote a story in the National Post, I believe it was yesterday, not a couple of days ago, about the chemistry on this team and how much they genuinely seem to like each other. And that seems like that only gets improvement from the addition of Marcus Stroman back into the rotation and back onto this roster. But David Price bought everybody robes, blue robes with their names and numbers on them. LaTroy Hawkins was loving his. And it's a question that gets asked a lot. What comes first? Is it the winning or is it the chemistry? And it's sure, it's easy to get along when you're winning baseball games, but is it impossible to be one of those winning culture teams without guys that get along? Because, Gary, like, these guys genuinely do seem to get along, and it's not just reports and what we see on TV. We have people that are there every day, like John Lott. They genuinely seem to like each other.
I mean, I think it certainly helps. I mean, when you're winning games, there's a lot less finger-pointing and a lot less blame to go around.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you need that to be a winning team. I mean, we've heard so many stories over the years about certain star players who are disliked in the locker room or in the clubhouse and such. So I don't think it's a necessity. I think what's more important is the matching robes. I mean, every good scooter gang needs matching robes for sure.
Yeah,
I mean, Kobe and Shaq didn't get along for a lot of those Lakers years. And that's a sport where they've actually got to pass to one another and be on the same page and stuff like that in a much greater way than a hitting lineup needs to be, say. So, yeah, I don't think it's necessary, but I do think it probably helps. You know, like if you can start winning some games, get some good vibes, and then, you know, use that to sort of get more connected with your teammates and stuff like that. We've got a great story in the magazine on the bullpen, sort of the impact that LaTroy Hawkins had on those other guys and, you know, instituting like bullpen dinners and stuff like that. Everywhere else LaTroy Hawkins had ever been, they always have bullpen dinners and they talk about stuff other than baseball just so they can get to know each other on a personal level. They can cheer for each other more, like at least according to LaTroy. And I think that does go a long way. Like, it's obviously all those guys are talking him up. It's like, hey, he's brought us together in a way that we weren't before. And I don't think that can hurt at all. Like, obviously, you know, it's going to come down to how well you pitch, you know, how your bullpen is looked at. But I think having a guy on your side and, you know, having a guy in your ear that you trust and taking tips and, you know, having a good feeling at the ballpark, I think that only helps.
And what's great about it is you got so many young players on this Blue Jays roster. You know, you've got a nucleus that's here for the next several years. So I think that kind of helps set the tone for these guys and see what a winning baseball team needs and the mentality you should have.
Well, and if David Price is not around long term, if this is just a short term deal and he goes to the Dodgers or whatever as a free agent, whoever offers him $300 million, what a great teacher, what a great mentor to have for a guy like a Marcus Stroman who gets called up and he gets to watch David Price go yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
as long as he doesn't take the robes with him.
That's right. Leave the robes. Yeah, they're not rentals. It is 11:46, Sportsnet Radio Network, Sportsnet Magazine Live, Ben Ennis, Craig Battle, Gary Mello. It's the first of two games, doubleheader today on Sportsnet Radio Network as well. It goes at 1:05, 12:30. Pregame on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network, also 12:30 on Sportsnet. And the second game will start a half hour after the conclusion of the first game, so a true doubleheader. Guys, I don't know if you noticed this, and the Royals have not played great baseball recently. They're still playing their special brand of baseball, throwing baseballs into people's backs like they did to Chris Davis yesterday. The Blue Jays now just three games back of that top spot in the American League. And yes, there's still plenty to play for as separating yourselves from the Yankees. But I wonder if that's a discussion that's taking place inside that clubhouse. Hey, yeah, we want to win the division. And yes, that's priority number one. But I wonder when they look at the out-of-town scoreboard, how much attention they are paying to the Kansas City Royals.
I mean, you'd have to be. The gap, you know, about a month ago, it didn't seem like they would close the gap this much. And now to only be three games back from the best record in the American League, you know, if you're able to win the division and go ahead and take the top record in the American League, it certainly sets up a more favorable matchup in the playoffs, right? You're all of a sudden getting the wild card winner instead of having to go to Houston. So I think that's fantastic. They've got to have one eye on that, you know, those stands. I think priority number one is winning the division.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can kind of continue to close the gap on the Royals and, you know, get in the discussion for top spot in the American League, that's fantastic.
It's my favorite time of the year as a baseball fan, because every game is so important and you get into divisional play. The way the schedules work out is they always save all these divisional games for the final month. And the Blue Jays only play one series that was not within the division in September. And that's the upcoming series in Atlanta against the Braves. last interleague series of the season. As far as the races in the National League, it's not so great, right? Like, there's not much going on. Maybe you can say the NL Central is a bit of a race, as the Pirates 4 games back of the Cardinals for top spot, and that was a deficit I didn't think they would be able to make up, because the Cardinals were on such an incredible roll, and the Pirates and Cubs are battling for home field in the one-game playoff. I'm not sure how important that is, but other than that, not much else going on as far as races in the National League. But in the American League, there's a bunch going on. You've got the Twins just a game back of the Rangers for that second wild card spot. The Angels, who have been such a huge disappointment, just 3 back. Maybe you can say the Indians are still there at 4.5. And the Rays only 5 back of the second wild card, but so many teams that they have to leapfrog. But I think the majority of the attention is going to be on the Rangers, who are in that second wild card spot, and the American League West, where there's still a three-team race between the Astros, who have been one of the surprises of this season, a game and a half up on the Rangers, and the Angels 4.5 games back. That seems like that could be a real fun race going down the stretch.
Absolutely. And I mean, we talked about interdivision games. LA has Houston, September 21st to the 23rd. They've got Texas, the final 4 games this season, October 1st to October 4th. So you could see, you know, LA walking in there a couple of games out and 4 games in Texas to determine the AL West winner, the AL West, the wild card, you know, who knows, right? Like, that is a fantastic finish to the season. Yeah, the NL, you know, I mean, Pittsburgh has 84 wins or something like that, which would put them first in the AL. But yeah, all they're competing for is the wild card at this point. But yeah, in the AL, I think it's great. I think that AL West is a really fun race.
Who's the team that scares the Blue Jays the most? Because we know we saw the Royals. And the Blue Jays took 3 out of those 4 games at Rogers Center. I don't know if that's a scary team necessarily for the Blue Jays. Is it the Yankees with the starters that they could throw at you in a short series where they haven't seen Tanaka yet, but they will see him? Tanaka, Pineda, and Severino, despite the fact that they lit him up, and the back end of that bullpen with Betances and Miller. Or is it a team that can hit home runs like the Astros? Or is it the Royals, who they did take 3-4 from?
I think it's got to be the Royals, despite them having some success to, you know, the last time they met in that 4-game set. You know, the Royals, they've been to the dance. They were there last year. You know, they're coming back into this postseason with a bit of a chip on their shoulder. You know, and then we saw a little bit of a little bit of bad blood between the two teams there. So I think the Royals are the one team that would have to scare the Blue Jays the most in the postseason.
Who would be the most fun? They're the most fun team for the Blue Jays to see in the postseason, right?
I want to see a 7-game set between those two teams.
The Yankees would be fun, too. I think, you know what, playoff baseball in the city, in general, might be pretty fun, as it looks like they're going to be headed there, whether it's a 1-game play-in situation or an actual 5-game series in a DS, and then maybe a CSNA, maybe a World Series as well.
Do you think Donaldson wants to face the Royals?
I think he does.
There's some good hitting. Yeah. The Royals. So.
If Edison Volquez gets a start in the postseason, yes, that's definitely a guy that Josh Donaldson wants to face. Blue Jays and Yankees once again, Game 2 of 4 this afternoon, 12:30, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Sportsnet Radio Network, and Sportsnet. And then 30 minutes after the conclusion of Game 1, Game 2, Marcus Stroman on the hill against Ivan Nova. That'll do it for another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live. I've got Sportsnet Today getting you set for Blue Jays baseball. I'll be joined by Mike Wilner coming up next. For Craig Battle, Gary Mello, this has been Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis, Sportsnet Radio Network.